Quickly, Harding Newman, Reel 5.
Yes. Regarding, as I say, the mechanical side, air filtering was one of the most important things, and there one did get this development of what they termed the oil bath air filter, which is a fairly large area bringing over which the air intake into the engine passed, which had wire gauze, which was covered with oil, and you had below it a certain amount of oil which was slopped about onto the wire gauze all the time. Therefore, all your air was passing over an oily surface, and that attracted all the dust and the sand, was pretty good. It was later they developed the felt filters, which had a large area of felt in the form of a concertina mesh, concertina thing, and that again proved effective. I never thought it was quite as good as the oil bath, because the oil bath was so easy to maintain. You washed it in petrol and you filled it with clean oil, which was not quite the same with the air filter, with the felt type of air filter. Otherwise than that, I think navigation, of course, was a problem, and how you did it with vehicles and the speed. But mechanically, I would say our problems were heating, of the overheating of the engine, the problem of cleaning the air, and the problem of tires, the type of tire which would carry the load and get us over the soft patches of sand, and therefore be able to follow the tracked vehicle virtually where it went to.
Yes, and we've covered now, have we, the results of your tests in as far as they directly led to advances in these fields of tires, heating.
I think so. The only other thing I think is minor interest, but the sort of way which people outside Egypt were thinking and referred to the Crossley armour, of Crossley 30 hundredweight load carrier. And when we were doing these tests of tyre, we were specifically sent out the various types of tyre from Egypt and told to put them on the vehicle. In one case, we were even told to put two twin tyres on the front wheels of a car, which we, from the very word go, said was quite ridiculous, but obviously we were told to do it, so we did it. And of course it made the vehicle virtually impossible to control or to go anywhere. It was fairly soon discarded, but we had to do it, which I think was interesting, that the sort of thing you were asked to do with people who probably merely had experience of Laffin's plane outside Aldershot, where there was a little bit of sand, but it was always wet sand and not dry sand, which is a very different problem.
Let's talk about the navigational experiments, which rather came under a separate head. How and for what reasons did you get into the field of looking at desert navigation problems at all?
Well, you left Cairo, and very shortly you get out of sight of the pyramids, and there were no landmarks. The maps were probably almost a plain sheet of paper with a few darbs or camel routes. A camel route is known as a darb. You might have those. You could have a few, in some cases, of the 1914 light carber trail, T model Fords, and certain civilian exploration trips under Kamal al-Din, Gaston Bay, various people who have been interested in the desert and had gone out in civilian vehicles. So that once you left the pyramids in your last sight of them, you were on your own, and you had to know A, where you were going, and generally you had an objective as to where to go to, and otherwise it might be an oasis, such as Bahar Air Oasis, it might be the Great Dunes, which were a dune line. But whatever it was, A, you wanted to get somewhere, and B, most important, you always wanted to know where we were and where you were going, how far in distance and what bearing you've been going on. And the initial way we used to use was initially the ordinary old prismatic compass, and you would take a bearing well away from the metallic car, and you would plot that bearing. You'd go on it for so many miles, and then you would change your bearing and hoped eventually you'd arrive at your destination. Well, then you got the oil compass, which is now the normal issue, But in those days, were very few and far between, and that was a much more easily used hand instrument, and it was not so affected by the metallic of the car. And then, combined with those compasses, we eventually started to borrow the Air Force aircraft compass, which was a gimbal mounted, a floating spherical ball, which we mounted on our vehicle, on the dashboard, under the aid and with the guidance of the Air Force. But of course that, in an aircraft, there is rarely, in those days, comparatively little metal compared to a vehicle, because it was canvas and wood or aluminium. And therefore they could set their compasses. I can't think of the right term now, but they had a platform in which you moved your vehicle, aircraft around to all points of the compass, and you took the variations of the compass on their particular point, so you knew it was 2 or 3 degrees out when it was reading due north and that sort of thing. Well, we tried doing that on our vehicles with an Air Force compass, but it varied. You can never have a constant one. It depended on the revs of the engine, the speed you were going. Therefore, it was only a guide, a rough guide, but it did mean that once you had taken your bearing to where you wanted to go, you could align the vehicle on that bearing and then read the Air Force compass. And you would stick to that Air Force reading so long as you were on that bearing and hope that it was reasonably accurate. But of course it was a very slow business, because every now and again you had to stop, check the compass bearing you were on and see whether the Air Force compass was still reading the same bearing when you started. Quite often it wasn't. And it made it very difficult, and when you came to any really rough going which you wanted to avoid, you can imagine the number of times you had to stop, get out and adjust, and it made it very slow, but it was possible and you could. We never lost ourselves. I won't always say we found the exact spot we were aiming for head on, but you got there sufficiently well to be able to do it. But they were really comparatively short trips of 100, 200, 300 miles, taking 4 or 5 days, a week or something like that, not doing any great distances, but testing your vehicle, your tyres, and recording the results, and navigating so that you could always turn around and go home again.
Apart from using these compasses, which you've mentioned, the prismatic, the oil compass, and the RAF compasses, which were using pieces of equipment that already exist, did you, in these navigational experiments, just develop any special compasses yourself?
Well, then you come on to the civilian side, which I was interested in, and you got this Major Bagnall, who is a signals and had been out there before 1930 and then gone to India and come back again in 1913, did a long desert trip out to the western desert, Libya, and again in 1932, which I took part in, and he developed what is known as the Bagnall Sun Compass, which were purely using the sun and had no magnetic influence, and therefore providing you had some, which you normally did, and you could look up the tables, which were the Nautical Almanac and Davis's azimuth tables, providing you could do that and set those readings according to your latitude and your longitude, that instrument was ideal, accurate, and could navigate you anywhere. Well, that was on the civilian side, and I never used that in the army until much later. But it was there in 1932 when I used it, and we had them specially made, and again in 1935. But the army, for some reason, never adapted it. They started on the various people interested in the army in a sun compass, and in the what were known as the desert surveys. They were the people of the Egyptian government responsible for surveying, well, all Egypt, Sinai, and all their territory. And there was one man called Clayton who was particularly interested in the desert side, the western desert, and did spend most of his time out there. And he helped various of the military people to develop the type of sun compass, which you didn't have to look up the various tables in the book. You had various plates, depending on your latitude, your time of day, which you could change and use, and they were adopted and used very much by the armoured car people and the light cars, such as the 8th Lancers. But they were all developed originally by, well, civilian trips, but military personnel, such as Bagnall, and then various other types were developed by the military people and the desert surveys. And they were used largely during the, latterly during the war, well, before the war, by various of the light, the car regiments, out of the 8th Lancers and the 12th Lancers, or 11th Hussars, who were out there then.
Did you have any association with the Royal Air Force in any work in Egypt in fields other than that of the compass and navigation?
Well, you always had, there were two in Cairo, based on Cairo Heliopolis Airport, we had two squadrons, the 208 Army Cooperation Squadron, which was purely Army cooperation, and of course with which we had tremendous liaison, and then you had the troop carrying 216 Squadron with their large aircraft, which would carry a platoon of men or something of that sort, limited mileage. But we did a very, very close liaison. Every trip we went out on, even whether it was a small trip, we always told the Air Force, the 208 Squadron mostly, and if they could come out and drop us some mail or see us, it helped them to get used to navigating over the desert, which was not easy for them. It helped us, and it gave us a bit of relief. And there was a tremendous liaison, particularly between ourselves, the tanks, and the Air Force, both sides of them, but more especially 208 Squadron. And then latterly, of course, as the 12th Lancers, 11th Hussars started to go out further into the desert, that liaison was continued by them. But there was that, and I personally always say that the Desert Air Force, as it was termed during the war, and the 8th Army, the whole cooperation was based on the initial cooperation we had with the Air Force, their understanding our problems, and we understanding their problems. And I think the Desert Air Force and the 8th Army cooperation was based on our work before the war with those particular people. And it still stood. And although the personnel in many cases changed, there were enough to continue it and to make it as good a cooperation as it was. And I think it was absolutely bar none in the war.
Did you get involved in any other mechanisation of other units apart from the 12th Lancers, which we've already mentioned?
Yes, well, one of my brother officers joined one of the summers, I think it was 1934 or thereabouts. He was given the job of converting the Chestnut Troop of the Royal Horse Artillery from the wheeled six-wheel tractor to the Dragon tracked vehicle to tow their guns. And he did this during the summer when I was on leave. And when I came back at the end of the summer, he said he was going to run a final trip, in other words, to get them out of the short sort of 5-10 mile radius of Abyssinia, which they were sick to death of, and to take them on one of the longer trips, which would give them a bit of a broader idea of the capability of the vehicle and the problems, both a bit on the delta and also on some sandy terrain, not quite the western desert, but it was sufficient to give them an idea of the capability of their vehicle to have a rough terrain. So I naturally said I'd love to do it, and we went and we took them fairly early start from Cairo through the main streets of Cairo and out on tracked road, desert on roads along the Nile to Helwan, and then we branched down into the rough going tracts, but I mean not no navigational problem as such, to take them down to the Red Sea, a place called Ras Zafarana, which were one of the lighthouses on the Red Sea. And it was most interesting because they had done manoeuvres with their horses previously and their tracked vehicles or their wheel vehicles. And we did, in before we gave them their, about their first hour, or it might have been 2 hourly, 20 minutes in 2 hour halt. And that was all the distance we covered then was virtually the same distance they covered in the whole of a day when they had their horses. And it impressed them straight away tremendous mobility we'd given them, what they got by using the tracked vehicles. We weren't, in fact, towing any guns then. We'd totally taken the tractors and a few wheel vehicles. And they were all most impressed. We got down to Ras Zafaran, I think, probably in 2 days or so. But I can remember we started off, I don't think we had a gunner officer. We merely had NCO, because a particular officer who I knew quite well was playing polo that afternoon, so it wasn't very convenient for him to come, so he was flown out. Another way of cooperation, or another instant of the cooperation between the RAF and ourselves, the army, because they flew him out to join us that evening, halfway down, and them landed, and he then continued with us down there. And that, I say, was purely personal cooperation between the individual concerned and the Air Force and the Army. And then we got down the other end, and I say we had obviously a certain amount of maintenance, but virtually a completely trouble-free trip down there. And I know most of the gunners got so excited they lay in the sun where they had nothing to do, no horses to look after, and got grossly sunburned. But we meant to doctor them up. And then on the way back, we'd got off the rough desert going. We were on the typical road of the Egyptian Delta, which is pure mud, and kept together by men going along, having allocated certain stretches of water, and throwing buckets of water over the mud to keep it, make it hard, so it didn't tear up too much. And one of these tractors got onto that, and steering a bit round a bend, and he went straight into the canal. And there it was, half submerged, which immediately gave us quite a problem on a fairly confined space to get him out. And that was, I must say, quite an interesting little job, I think, to the best of my recollection. We did have, certainly, the backing of some of the ordnance, equivalent of the Remy nowadays, and with various tractors and vehicles and tow ropes, we managed to pull it out. I'm not sure now whether it was still capable of going or whether we probably towed it home, but it was just an incident on a very trouble-free trip we'd had so long, and suddenly the whole thing was held up for several hours. And if it had been a military manoeuvre, the sort of case where I always say a little care and get your vehicle there, the other end, complete with its crew. Makes so much difference to the battle in the end. And if you are careless for one small incident and don't appreciate your road conditions or your vehicle, then you can virtually ruin the battle. But it was an interesting and very enlightening, gratifying trip, the efficiency of these people. The Chestnut Troop, I suppose, being one of the absolute elite of the Royal Horse Artillery, to see them and their adaptation to this form of transport. And their enthusiasm to it all.
Were you sensitive to any qualitative differences in attitude or experience between, on the one hand, the mechanization of cavalry units and, on the other, the mechanization of artillery units?
No, not really. I think the whole background to it must be the fact that they all had gone into the regiment because of their love of the horse and their ability and interest in maintaining and riding horses. And there you have the background, it's just the same in both cases, really. Once it came to mechanization and giving up their horses, I don't suppose there was a great deal of difference. Of course, it never affected the other ranks in the same way as it did the officers. The other ranks were there for a comparatively short space of time, perhaps maybe 5 years, 8 years, on the regular army and so much on the reserve. And therefore it wasn't, but for the officers, of course, it was her lifetime. It was their career, and in many cases they were staying for 20 or 25 years. And therefore they felt it far more, I think. And but I wouldn't say there was any great difference. The difference always lay in the good regiment and the poor regiment. And in the good regiment, they may have disliked having to be mechanized intensely, But they accepted it, they saw the possibilities, and they went knuckle down to it and went into it as they were going to anything which we knew and gave them something which was going to improve their efficiency.
I was wondering whether the artillery being in its own right a technically orientated arm made the process of mechanizing their units somewhat simpler than with the cavalry.
I wouldn't have thought so, really and truly, because the handling of a gun, a lot of people, I would say that in the day of the horse, you went at a certain speed, maybe 2.5-3 miles an hour, that sort of thing, and you knew exactly what happened to your gun. It was mounted on metal wheels, but no harm came. And then you got doing those same metal wheels towed behind a machine doing double the speed. Therefore, you had problems with the gun as a gun, and it upset the sighting, it shook it to pieces, in other words. And therefore, I think the difference was only on the technical gun side. And they were worried more about how you're going to ruin their ability to shoot straight or to shoot their machine by the maltreatment it had in the hands of a mechanical vehicle.
Now, having finished with the experimental aspect of your work, I want to move back to somewhat more routine battalion duties when you became a section commander in, I think, about 33. Becoming involved again in sort of mainline tank corps activities in Egypt, I recollect last time we talked, you made the observation as regards the tank corps' relations with other arms of the service in the Middle East, that feelings against us were very strong in Egypt, and I wonder if you could explain in a little detail what you meant by that.
Well, I think again, it of course, it's a continuation really, the feeling you got in England, that out there it was the same, you were a dirty, smelly machine, and no one wanted you particularly near them. You had to work noisily at all times of the day or night, and half the time through the night, when in many cases they could bed down, or a majority of them could bed down when the others were on guard or patrolling. And I think there was that feeling against us. You would disturb their peace, their routine. You were something new, and you were rather a nuisance, probably. Failing to understand the support and the strength you would give them if it came to an actual war or anything of that sort. If not, I think, appreciate it then. They didn't look ahead enough to what value you could be. And I would say there was a great lack of cooperation, a feeling of wanting to try and work out a coordinated or a tactical schemes with tanks. It was not always the case, but otherwise I would say quite a lot of it. And there's no doubt that if you found an infantry battalion or company marching along in the desert, slogging it along in most uncomfortable condition, and you drove up alongside them, and I must say at times you didn't always go downwind on them, and of course you cover them in filth and muck. Sometimes it was impossible to choose. I mean, it wasn't always a case of just being stupid or not thinking. And therefore, it was a noisy, dirty thing which came along, and people rather felt further away they are from me, the better I'm pleased, forgetting the potential.
Did these kinds of prejudices have any practical consequences as far as RTC activities in Egypt were concerned, that you could put your finger on?
No, I wouldn't think so. Because we weren't, I know, popular with some of the high-up generals. Again, they didn't accept the tank as being the war-winning weapon which many of us thought it was, and therefore we were not given perhaps the best of opportunity to show our value in any scheme of manoeuvres. That certainly, I'm sure, applied later on, not perhaps so much in the 35 period, but a little later on. And But I don't think there was certainly no feeling of enmity between the other ranks or the officer, the junior officer of any of the various arms out there. We all got on extremely well. It was merely a feeling that they had their own way of life and battle, and we had ours. And when you were on manoeuvres and training, the two didn't often mix very friendly, in a friendly atmosphere. But when you were away and in the sporting social field, the feeling was always extremely pleasant, and we always had tremendous friends between all arms out there.
I've read that one of the particular problems for the RTC in Europe, in Egypt rather, were presented by virtue of the, did arise through the personality of Lindsay. I wondered whether any of your experiences would have confirmed or otherwise that.
He, of course, was a great help to us. And we all thought, of course, he had the right outlook and the right idea that any war would be fought in the desert, or a large part of it would, and therefore he gave us a Philip. But I'm not sure that his outlook was accepted by those up above, and therefore I would suspect that some of the ideas that he would like to put across, or would have liked to have tried, and some of the technical work he would like to try, was frowned upon and was not incorporated in the exercise we took part in to our advantage, or to the advantage of, not necessarily our advantage, the advantage of mechanization in its true sense. That I would think is true. It's very obvious when he left that the Western Desert, he knew his successor, the Western Desert, forgotten, nay, I'm not going to fight any war there. It'll be in Palestine. Direct all your thoughts now towards Sinai and Palestine, not toward the Western Desert. And that was a very clear change of attitude in headquarters, which we felt and saw.
As a section commander with the 6th Battalion, how did your routine training activities compare or contrast with the training routines which were possible in the United Kingdom? Were they comparable, or were there limitations?
Comparable in many respects. In other words, one's routine training was the same, a different, of course, different period of the year. Your leave period, your individual training period in Egypt was during the summer when you thought you couldn't go and fight in the desert, and therefore that was done there, and people went on leave and you got, say, 2 months leave. And then your tactical outdoor exercise training was done in the autumn, in the winter period when it was cool, which contrasted, it's exactly the opposite, of course, to England. But other than that, one's training was the same. Your individual training started to get your gunners, your drivers all trained up, because they changed over fairly regularly. Each year you lost some and got new ones in. So that was the same. And then you went on to your troop training, your company or squadron training, and then your battalion training, taking then finally the big exercise with the battalion, going out with other battalions, regiments, etc. So the actual basics were just the same, but the period in which you did the things were different. Tactically, of course, once one moved out on the bigger exercise, it was entirely different insofar that the terrain dictated so much of what you could do. Obviously, the infantry could not march in the same way across the desert, or nor could the horses, and the horses always had, you had to worry about where you could water them. You couldn't carry the water, therefore you had to go to where there was a water supply fairly near, either in the delta or near to the edge of the desert. They couldn't go far afield, and therefore your exercises, once it was men and horses, were very restricted. To us it was restricted in so far as to how far what the support vehicles could transport your petrol requirements, and that limited us into the amount of mileage we could do and the distance one could go, say, from tracks or fairly well-worn tracks or roads, mostly tracks if we got into the desert.
Were the tank corps components in Egypt fully integrated into the major training exercises of
yes,
the army
were.
In that area?
Oh, yes, they took part. But as I said, I think we had the feeling that we weren't a popular arm, they didn't foresee the possibilities, and therefore seldom was an exercise made with the idea of giving the tanks